All right, so why don't we get started? Tonight, Dr. Ferrer is going to join us again. We're going to talk about some of the technology around deception detection and some of the other neurotechnology-related things that I talk about in Mind Wars, and that will sort of give us a head start on some of the topics that I'll be talking about probably next week. Tonight, I want to spend the first X minutes, because who knows how long this will go, just walking through a little bit more of the history of biosecurity. Again, my purpose in doing that is to lay the groundwork for neuroscience and national security, since I don't want you to walk out with the impression that all of the interesting national security and military-related issues in science start with neuroscience. They actually start with biosecurity and chemical weapons. So that's why I'm doing this again, just to remind you of that for just a few minutes. And so I think I got up to the point last time where we were just pointing out that people like Koch and Pasteur actually used agents like smallpox and anthrax in their experiments. And these were obviously also among the horrible scourges of humankind. So there was a lot of interest in them at a kind of basic science level and in terms of what you could actually do in the field to apply this knowledge. And in an incredibly complicated story that I'm just connecting the dots here is that a lot of this knowledge ends up being used by the Imperial Japanese during the second... Well, actually, it starts with the invasion of Manchuria in 1934, I think it is. The Japanese invasion of Manchuria around 34. They set up what was called the Water Purification Bureau in Harbin, which was actually just the reverse of water purification. It's kind of an Orwellian newspeak, if you think about it. And what they were really doing was they were developing chemical and biological weapons. The story of the Pingfan complex of the unit that General Ishiro Ishii, who's a physician, created is now a matter of lots of scholarship. I think I mentioned that there are Japanese and Chinese scholars who are writing about this. It really, I think the beginning of this was a book called Factories of Death, which was published about 15 years ago by a historian who's since passed away, an American. But the Japanese and Chinese have picked up on it. There have been lots of meetings in Harbin at the site, convention conferences, and scholarly materials. And this is still a sore point in Sino-Japanese relations, because the Japanese, as you know, will not take responsibility for anything that was done under the previous regime, the imperial regime. And think of the comfort women, the prostitutes that were taken from Korea. The same is true of these experiments. There's also an incredibly complicated story that I tell partly in Undue Risk, the book that I published 13 years ago. Is a chapter that includes a description of the machinations between the Americans and the Japanese after the war, involving General MacArthur, who is, was the Viceroy of Japan. There are some historians who believe that General MacArthur, upon learning about the biological and chemical weapons experiments that were done in China, decided that we would keep that information to ourselves as much as possible. Interestingly, the Soviets did do a show trial, I think it was in 48 or 49, of some of the Japanese scientist doctors that they captured when they got Manchuria back at the end of the Second World War. And they all gave confessions, and I believe they were all executed. But there was no such trial with respect to the Pingfan complex on the American side. And there were allegations during the Korean War. I think Mao and Cho Enlai believed this anyway, that the Americans had used some biological agents during the Korean War. But I think that is definitely a minority view among historians. Most historians don't think that was actually true. In any case, the point is that you have these really good biologists and physicians like Ishii, who you know are who have been the beneficiaries of all of this 19th century biology, right? And now they're using it for warfare purposes. At least, according to this, what I've read, at least 10,000 people died in what were essentially open dissections at the Pingfan complex, live dissections. They open people up, they put stuff in them, and they see what would happen. What they were really specializing in, it seems, though, was ways of delivering, for example, lice that were infected with various bacteria in a more efficient way on the battlefield. So, for example, the one device that sticks in my mind is, you know, the problem with a lot of this stuff is that if you send it in such a way that it detonates, it burns up the bugs, right? So you can't have that. So they actually had developed a device that always struck me, that was a bomb and a chain with a clay pot behind it, and the shock wave from the bomb, right, when it went off, would shatter the clay pot over whatever the population was that you wanted to get sick, enemy soldiers or whatever it was. So sort of very ingenious devices. But this was a huge factory-like complex in Harbin. And I mention it because it is a kind of, again, it's a product of, you know, this is what people call dual-use technology. Right? Basic science, good medicine, a lot of bad, but some bad stuff, terrible, terrible stuff. In fact, some people think that some epidemics were created by Ishii and his unit that actually were still had effects as far away as Beijing in the early 1950s. It's very hard to prove this, but there are people who believe that was true. What I've mentioned to you, the trial of the 23 Nazi doctors and medical bureaucrats at the end of the Second World War in Nuremberg, Germany. These were the experiments that were in the indictment, and I'll just point out that besides the malaria experiments, and there were also mustard gas experiments, and there were epidemic jaundice experiments. They were interested in the new sulfa drugs, sulfanilamide, so they would create injuries and infect them, and then they try to see if the sulfa drugs worked. Many of the experiments that were done in the concentration camps were again part of the knowledge base, came out of the knowledge base of the modern microbiology. And there were prison malaria experiments. Did I talk about these? I remember now. I talk about these so much. The prison malaria experiments were done by the U.S. government in federal penitentiaries in the United States. To get better treatments for malaria. To start to bring us into what is for me the modern era, but for many of you is ancient history, the 1950s. In 1953, the Secretary of Defense signs a memorandum establishing the rules that the United States would live by for doing human experiments on atomic, biological, and chemical weapons. ABC Warfare Research, it was called for short at that time. This is the memorandum. It was once top secret, but no longer top secret, no worries. There's a long backstory behind this memorandum in February 53 from the Secretary of Defense that I tell in Undue Risk, which I'm not making you read. But you're certainly free to if you want to. There's a chapter about the way that the Pentagon adopted this policy, which was quite controversial. And what I want you to notice is basically, we could go through this, sort of dissect the document. It's quite interesting from a kind of legal standpoint. But this first term, this first sentence here, I want you to notice, is the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. And that should ring a bell with at least some of you. That is the first sentence of the Nuremberg Code. Actually, if you go through this memo, which I won't do, but there's another two pages of it, you see that the whole policy is cribbed verbatim from the Nuremberg Code. So what's interesting is that the only federal agency that has ever adopted the Nuremberg Code verbatim as its policy for doing human experiments for atomic, biological, and chemical weapons research is the Pentagon, which should be, that should strike you as an interesting historical factoid. But again, there's a whole story about why they adopted this. The lawyers in the Pentagon believed that this was valid international law and that they had to abide by it. After all, we'd hanged 7 people as a result of violating medical ethics, they thought, violating the Nuremberg Code. Actually, they were wrong. The 7 men who were hanged in the Nazi as a result of the Nazi doctor's trial, and the 8 more who were imprisoned, were hanged and imprisoned because they were involved in killing people, not because they violated medical ethics. In the context of the death camps, you know, medical ethics is not among the top 3 things that you have to worry about. I mean, it's one of the bad things, but you know, they were killing people, and they were doing barbarous, cruel things to people. And in fact, the Nuremberg Code did not exist until the trials were settled, and the judges wrote their decision. But nonetheless, even lawyers make mistakes. And they thought it was international law. It probably really wasn't. In any case, it was adopted by the Pentagon in 1953. Now, to continue on the theme of biological weapons, and we can talk more about this if you like, but just to kind of continue on the theme of the history, this is the 8-ball. Anybody been to Frederick, Maryland, seen the 8-ball? It's still there. The 8-ball is a 1,000 millimeter cloud chamber that was built in the early 50s at what was then Camp Dietrich, now Fort Dietrich, to do biological weapons experiments. I have a couple of more images here. This is the 8-ball as it appeared when there was a wooden building around it, which burned down. And these are the dosimetry devices under the 8-ball. They're measuring the number and size of the molecules of whatever poisonous stuff that they are sending up into the 8-ball that day. These are dosimeters. And these are the 2 of the volunteers who are inhaling the stuff that's in the 8-ball that day. Now you may ask yourself, why would people volunteer for this? So these were actually Seventh-day Adventists for the most part. There was a special arrangement between the Army and the Seventh-day Adventist Church of the Maryland area that soldiers who were SDAs would be exempt from combat duty. And remember, this is the mid-50s, so, you know, Cold War is hot in Korea and could be caught again, so it's an issue. They would be exempt from combat duty if they volunteered to be, not to put too fine a point on it, human guinea pigs in biological weapons experiments. This was not secret. This was called Project White Coat. There's stuff on the web about it. It's fascinating. And this is one of the. This is a page from the brochure that the Seventh-day Adventist Church published to show how patriotic their people were. Can't read the caption here. Rift Valley Fever Project volunteers take an outdoor break from hospital routines. Keeping fit calls for creativity when you are confined to the hospital. Yes, indeed. The stationary bike helps provide an opportunity. So these are people who were in a Rift Valley fever experiment. Rift Valley fever is a problem in Africa in the Rift Valley. And so this was the kind of thing that was being done, and that's who was doing it. If we can bring the lights down, if I can get this arrow to be in the right place, show you very briefly, just to make the point that this was not secret, this was quite public, a little film about what was going on at Camp Dietrich. Time. I gotta find the button. This is always hard. Where are you, button? The names of them, see if we can find them. This way. No, there's an on button here. Bear with me. Okay.
click somewhere on the image.
Yeah.
Sometimes that works.
Sometimes, but not tonight. The problem is that the button is probably just underneath. So let's do this. Let's see if I can. It's up a little bit. Oh, life sucks. All right, well, I'm not going to bother with this. I'll show it to you later. It's too hard. So, meanwhile, after, if I can get it, I'll do it after the break. So, meanwhile, back in the Soviet Union, in 1969 and 72, 73, the Nixon administration signs off on a number of international conventions controlling biological and chemical weapons. The Soviets sign it too, but they don't believe it. So they decide to go way underground and continue their biological weapons program. It was called Biopreparat. It employed throughout the Soviet Union upwards of 40, 50,000 people, highly compartmentalized. Apparently a lot of people didn't know what they were working on. But this is one of the big programs. This is one of the big buildings in Biopreparat. Even this continued even during the Gorbachev era. In fact, was not completely shut down until Boris Yeltsin took over. The United States spent a lot of money and resources after the collapse of the Soviet Union, sending people over there to make sure that the physical and intellectual assets of Biopreparat were not being sold off to the highest bidder. I actually talked to one of these guys on an airplane flight once. It was a total coincidence, but he had spent time in Siberia at one of these sites. And again, the problems were both the stuff has to be destroyed, and they had tons and tons and tons of this stuff from fermenters. And you had to make sure that the disgruntled scientists, you know, didn't go to somewhere we didn't want them to go with the knowledge they had. So this is a huge effort that the United States did, and a very successful one in the early 1990s. So these are this is a slide that just summarizes some of the history, some other elements of the history. A lot of people are surprised by this, especially there was a big concern that anthrax would be used as a biological weapon against soft targets like the subway system in New York. So they used what are called simulants, spread them around. This was done in a number of places, here's some of the places, including L.A., probably Palo Alto, through the 50s, 60s, and again in the late 90s. And the simulants changed over the decades because some of them turned out to be maybe not so simulate. There might have been one death in Palo Alto because somebody's immune system was kicked off by some of this stuff. This is still highly debatable. Not all the data is public, but we know that a lot of this was done. And if this strikes you as odd, the Frank Olson bit is a reference to the CIA's anthrax expert who was given LSD at Fort Detrick in 1953. I think I might have mentioned this case to you. And this is the guy who was either committed suicide or was pushed out of the window of the hotel across from Penn Station, Madison Square Garden. So there's, there are a lot of links here that we don't fully understand. And if this strikes you as odd, just remember that the Aum cult in Tokyo actually used the subway system, right? And they distributed sarin. In the subway system. So there were and remain concerns about the use of these kinds of chemicals and bacteria in confined spaces like subway systems. Just to, again, bring this a little more up to date, the Defense Department required anthrax vaccination in Desert Storm, Desert Shield. Very complicated story here. The FDA actually had to give a waiver of informed consent because the anthrax vaccine is approved for cutaneous transmission of anthrax through the skin, but is not approved for inhalational anthrax. which means that it was essentially a kind of massive clinical experiment. But the FDA gave them a waiver. Many of the people who came back from Desert Storm, Desert Shield, then began suffering from these mysterious symptoms, and they believed that one of the sources of the symptoms that they were having, their Gulf of what was called Gulf War syndrome, Gulf War illness, might have been the anthrax vaccine in combination with other things that they got. If you want to read what I consider to be in a conspiracy theory view of this, called Vaccine A, the book was published about this. I got into a tussle with the author because I reviewed it for the Washington Post when they were still doing book reviews. That book review section no longer exists, not because of me, it just doesn't exist anymore. But I think, if you want to see a very complicated theory about the notion that people wanted to experiment on soldiers using anthrax, that's an example. Nonetheless, it is extremely controversial still among the vets who still believe that the vaccine was the cause of some of their disorders in the 90s. Yeah.
So did they not follow up on the vaccine since
then? There have been follow-ups. People have been there's a big program. And every time veterans allege some kind of harm, the DOD and the VA have to do follow-ups. And so far, I don't think anybody is persuaded that it was the anthrax vaccine itself that caused Gulf War illness. In fact, even what Gulf War illness is remains controversial. Okay. A lot of people still think it's psychogenic because the kinds of symptoms people have, headaches, aches and pains and fatigue, that's very subjective. There are people who think that it has to do with the destruction of T cells, that it attacked the immune system. It's sort of amazing that we still don't really have consensus about what's going on with Gulf War illness. This is a program to test smallpox vaccine that was recruiting people through 9/11, and after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, people were lining up to be part of this smallpox vaccine experiment at places like St. Louis University Law School. So the point here is, this experiment doesn't look like something I want to be part of until this thing happens, and then all of a sudden, no, maybe I do want to be part of it, because who knows, just in case. There was also talk about doing smallpox vaccination studies in children in the months after 9/11. There's some literature about this. I think finally the NIH decided that was not a good idea. The smallpox vaccine is probably the most dangerous of the vaccines, and so finally they decided not to do it in kids. However, as you may know, and this goes on, and I think I might have mentioned this, the President's Commission on Bioethics is currently considering whether the anthrax vaccine should be tested for safety in children. So they're going to have a report about that in the next couple of months. So, this stuff just goes on and on and on. And anthrax is one of the top biological threats that is on a list that Homeland Security and DOD have. So it's not something to be shrugged off. But the ethics of doing even a safety study in kids is obviously somewhat complicated. This is one of the stories that was up in 2002 about the consideration a year after 9/11. Of doing the smallpox vaccines in kids, and again, this was the plan, but they backed off from that. Then a couple of years later, more worry about smallpox. This just goes on and on and on, and I'm going to just show you one little story about this that I think is quite interesting. So, one of the problems with getting drug approval for anything that has to do with biosecurity or chemical weapons defense. The anthrax vaccine is an example. Another example is the kinds of if you're exposed to, say, a mustard gas or any burn agent, any lotion that you might want to distribute to people to help them treat their injuries, or something called pyridostigmine bromide, which is a partly protective against nerve gas exposure, PB. If you want to get any of these things approved, how do you do that, right? Because after all, you can't, again, expose somebody to, you know, nerve gas or anthrax or smallpox in order to test your stuff, right? So how do you do it? And this is a, this was a puzzle, and this is a puzzle that actually I first learned about in the late 90s when they were trying to figure out how to get a Bayer product called Cipro, just in case anybody was exposed to inhalational anthrax. This is 1998. Just in case anybody was exposed to inhalational anthrax, which was a complete, you know, like a science fiction story, surely that wouldn't happen. But just in case a large population was exposed, Bayer had this fluoroquinolone called Cipro. So one day meeting, 1998, I was in Rockville to be the bioethicist for 6 hours to be part of this meeting, should Cipro be approved or not. The problem with it was, of course, that there was a lot of clinical information about Cipro, and there was experimental information from primates, non-human primates. But there was no experiment with ciprofloxacin for people who had actually been exposed to anthrax, again, because that would be unethical to do a controlled study of that. So basically, FDA decided that they would create a rule, a new rule, coming out of the Cipro experience, which said this stuff can be approved if you have safety trials in humans, but for efficacy, you have to do it in animals. Okay, so that was the deal with Cipro. That is why, if you remember, when Senator Daschle's staff and other people on the Hill were exposed to the anthrax envelopes, what did they get? Anybody knows who worked up there? They got Cipro, which is pretty heavy stuff, actually. And they were on it for 3 months, and a number of them felt pretty crappy for 3 months while they were on it. But that's how the system was able to move so easily into giving them Cipro. Okay? Now, then you have, on that model, and there's hardly any writing about this, interestingly, but on that model, there is now what's known as the animal rule. So that now you can test drugs that you couldn't, that were had great importance. And notice, it's when efficacy studies cannot be done in humans. You can test drugs under the animal rule. Safety in humans, but efficacy in animals, and preferably two animals, and preferably one of them as a primate. So this is quite a departure. This was an interesting move 10 years ago because it meant, you know, no human human efficacy testing. So that's not insignificant. What else do I have here? Okay, so these were the conditions. I'll put these slides up. Unethically exposed humans and so forth. And by the way, there are huge problems with protecting people from radiation, dirty bombs, actual nuclear detonation. We still don't have good stuff, and it's very difficult to know how to do these human experiments to protect people from radiation. If you remember after Three Mile Island, I know you don't, but some of you were around at that time, what they were doing was when they were evacuating people from the Three Mile Island area, they would set up these outposts on the interstate, giving them what? Iodine. That's basically all you could do for the thyroid. Not much we can do. I'll put these up, and some of you will find this amusing. So, questions, comments, anything on any of this? That's as far as I'm going to go with chemical and biological, but I'm happy to entertain any questions. So we're still in an era in which we're wrestling with these problems. How do you protect populations, civilian populations? How do you learn what works and yet do that within the framework of medical ethics? And this turns out to be very challenging. So what I'm going to do, when Professor Farah happily is with us again, is spend another half hour or so starting to get into the mind wars stuff. I asked you to read 2 chapters for tonight and 2 for next week. You may feel completely free to read the whole book. There will be no demerits if you happen to read the whole book. But I'm going to focus on certain issues, and this is sort of what I want to remind you of in the beginning, and a little plug here for Dr. Farah's neuroscience boot camp, which she can tell you about. The whole question of neuroscience and national security, for me, is a fantastic way to focus on many of the issues that we've talked about this fall. It seems to me that all of these problems are intensified when we get into the national security context. All of the ethical issues, all the social issues, all the legal issues. And they're not only intensified when we start talking about national security, in a way, they're even more puzzling. Because as I just tried to suggest with respect to the history of biosecurity and chemical weapons, the security, when you get into the national security area, as we saw with the people who lined up for the smallpox vaccine experiment all of a sudden in St. Louis, right, after the anthrax virus, so it's a good idea to be a human subject in an anthrax experiment. Our willingness to experience higher levels of risk is greater when, you know, we feel personally threatened. And certainly, as a polity, the country has shown time and time again that our willingness to tolerate risk, not only risk for our human subjects, but of course risks for people who serve in the military, is greater when we feel that we are under an existential threat. So when the polity is threatened, our willingness to accept certain kinds of risks for certain groups of people goes up. Now, what's really interesting about this story with respect to neuroscience is that there's this, and I just arbitrarily pulled some graphs off the web. If you look at just about any way of measuring the growth of neuroscience, and again, Martha can tell you more about this than I can, from the early 90s on, it's spectacular. There's huge growth measured in terms of the numbers of people who attend neuroscience meetings, Society for Neuroscience. You can't even walk on the sidewalks within 10 blocks of the SFN meetings anymore, whether they're in New York, in Chicago, or Washington. There are upwards of 40,000 people who attend the Society for Neuroscience, including people like me who sneak in. Right? So, actually, not including, probably another 5,000 people who just sneak in. Measured in terms of numbers of papers, obviously measures in terms of the money that's allocated for grants, only getting bigger and bigger from the early 90s, and a corresponding interest in the military in neuroscience. So this is some data. As far as I know, the only person who's looked at this is Margaret Kosal of Georgia Tech. This is the amount of money that's spent on what is called, this is fiscal year 2011, what is called cognitive neuroscience. And that's not all of neuroscience. That's just a bite of neuroscience. And by the way, if you look at different agencies in the United States that fund neuroscience, you will see different definitions of neuroscience, and you'll see different definitions of cognitive neuroscience. So you will be frustrated if you try to find out what the whole government actually spends on neuroscience. But nonetheless, what we can say is that this is the amount of money, like $400 million that was spent in fiscal year 2011, just on cognitive neuroscience. DARPA, she just said at least $240 million now. DARPA is, I think you should know by now, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. DARPA's budget is about $3 billion, which is dollars against pennies. It's not even a rounding error now, right, in our federal budget. But $240 million, roughly, that's, you know, that's more than I make in a year. So that's some money there. I asked one of my research assistants to go back to the Web of Science, which is a way of collection of papers that it's in the science lit, and just see, is there a 9/11 effect? In other words, if you look for keywords in the neuroscience literature, like terrorism, you know, brainwashing, interrogation. There's a bunch of words, and there. This is in the book. You see a very interesting kind of 9/11 effect. Right? That is to say that there's more and more funding for what we just might call loosely neuroscience and national security, national defense-related topics. And this makes perfect sense because if you are a scientist and you know you've got some proposals on your hard drive and you haven't been able to find funding for them. Not that anybody you know, like Dr. Farah would do this, but you know, you might tweak it a little bit if there's a new request for proposals that comes out of a place like DARPA, and you might say, well, gee, there's a way to get something of interest to this federal agency into that proposal. You tweak it a little bit, you send it in. And this is sort of what you expect to see. This is normal science. You know, science chases the money. And now you see a little drop-off. My guess is that gradually, over the next 5 or 6 years, you'll see it. Why is there that reduction? Because now this knowledge is being absorbed by the rest of the science system. So this is kind of interesting. And by the way, a bunch of Danes have done the same study for biology in general, and you see the same curve since 9/11. So more money for biology, more money for neuroscience, life sciences in general, coming out of the national security system. That's the title, that's the cover of the book, you know that cover. So this is sort of my little outline that we're going to walk through tonight and next week. So before neuroscience, and I think we've talked about this a little bit in terms of the way that the anatomists became interested in the 18th, 19th century and how the brain localizes its functions. I talked to you about how much I love William James and the principle of psychology. Now Lumosity, that company I mentioned, and others calling themselves, they're interested in the science of neuroplasticity, which poor Professor James, if only he had trademarked the word neuroplasticity, all of the generations of Jameses would be wealthy, but he didn't. So let's see if I can make this one work. So this is from a film some of you might have seen or your parents saw. And I'm just going to show you the beginning of this. This still starts to freak people out, this question of what's really going on. The book is called The Manchurian Candidate. What's really going on with the way that people's brains can be managed after the Second World War? New drugs, new threats to national security. How can we shape people's minds? And again, as I think I pointed out to you, this is sort of current because Mitt Romney's dad had this in mind, pun intended, when he said that he'd been brainwashed by the generals to supporting the Vietnam War. Uh-oh. Don't worry. If we're going to be able to do this one.
The war in Korea was over. Captain, now Major Bennett Markle, had been reassigned to Army Intelligence in Washington. It was, by and large, a pleasant assignment, except for one thing. Night after night, the Major was plagued by the same reoccurring nightmare.
This, by the way, made Frank Sinatra a star again, this movie. It wasn't doing too well. Because all those, like, Paul Anka and Elvis Presley, you know, they were selling records and he wasn't.
Another modern discovery which we owe to the hydrangea concerns the influence of air drainage upon plant life. Many years ago, when I was traveling about...
I saw this trailer when I was 10 years old. I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on.
Hydrangeas on the hills, where the air drainage was perfect, and very poor specimens, or perhaps none at all, in the valleys. Formerly, we used to consider sheltered valleys more favorable to plants than hilltops. But the avoidance of late spring and early autumn frost enjoyed by sites with good air drainage, where the cold air can drain safely away to lower levels, gives the hills a decided advantage.
Anybody seen this movie?
Thus it was the hydrangeas that gave the first pointer in another modern discovery of horticultural importance. From this, it might appear that the hydrangea is a fairly simple plant, but there are more complications. The cultivation of hydrangeas was evolved from the number of varieties originally found in Japan. Not all of which, of course, have the same characteristics. Two of them do not share the quality of producing blue flowers in mineral-rich soils.
Allow me to introduce our American visitors. I must ask you to forgive their somewhat lackadaisical manners, but I have conditioned them, or brainwashed them, which I understand is the new American word. Believe that they are waiting out a storm in the lobby of a small hotel in New Jersey, where a meeting of the Ladies' Garden Club is in progress.
You will notice that I have told them they may smoke. I've allowed my people to have a little fun in the selection of bizarre tobacco substitutes. Are you enjoying your cigarette, Ed?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Doug. Oh, tastes good. Like a cigarette should. Now then, comrade.
May I present the famous Raymond Shaw?
Young man, you've flown 8,000 miles to this dreary spot. Manchuria to see. Raymond, pull your chair over here by me, please.
All right. You get the general idea. So, by the way, some of the nastier political ads about China really remind me of the way that Asians were treated in this trailer and this film, but never mind. So what's going on there, of course, is that some of our prisoners of war during the Korean War were subjected to what came to be known in the journalist actually coined this term in the early 50s, brainwashing, whatever that means. And you know, what happens is that when you have these neologisms, thought stops. Because nobody thinks, well, what exactly does that mean? What is that process? Very similar to Satanism in the 90s. You know, it's satanic. Whatever happened in this crime is Satan. So that explains it. So brainwashing was taken to kind of explain things. It is true, certainly, that a lot of these men signed false confessions. They confessed to treason. When they got back, there was a lot of concern about what had been done to them. Why was this so effective? The security community believed that perhaps the North Koreans and the Red Chinese, as we called them then, call them that anymore. We're sort of friendlier now. I don't know. Maybe we're not. I can't tell. That they had some secret Asian weapon that they were able to use. Maybe it was LSD. Maybe it was hallucinogens. Who knows? Actually, it turned out to be a big disappointment. They were just really good at using peer pressure and group techniques, which actually had been developed also by the British and the Americans during the Second World War. Nonetheless, for various reasons, these guys cracked. They came back. They obviously had some, what we today call some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. But Alan Dulles, who was the first director of the CIA, by the way, his brother is the person after whom Dulles Airport is named, Don Foster Dulles, 50 years, by the way, of Dulles Airport anniversary this year. So you wanted to know that. He actually went to Cornell University Medical School and asked two famous neurologists named Wolf and Hinkle to review the question, what happened to our men in Korea? Was it, you know, some kind of big oriental secret? Was it a drug? What was it? No, it was just really good pressure, especially in groups, peer pressure. And so we're very familiar with the false confession problem now. You can give somebody a suggestion when they're being interrogated, and if they're terrified enough, they will say exactly what you want them to say. They will follow up, and they'll try to figure out what the interrogator wants them to say, what the line of questioning is, what the narrative is in the interrogator's mind. It's pretty familiar stuff now. It wasn't so familiar then. But that's basically what happened. And then they put you in groups, and we also know from social psychology that if you're in a group and everybody believes something, you tend to believe it too. There's a lot of experience with that in social psychology experiments that were done in subsequent years. So Alan Dulles gets Wolf and Hinkle to report. Big disappointment. Probably weren't using hallucinogens nonetheless. I think I mentioned, did I mention Sidney Gottlieb to you, the CIA spy master, who did some of these experiments, and this is a document. Did I show you this? I talk about this a lot, so forgive my... yes, okay. So you've seen this document already, $37,000 for LSD experiments in the mid-50s, and some of you have probably also seen this video, but on the off chance that you haven't, I'm going to show it to you now. But not yet. But I'm still going to give it a shot. Got to get that arrow in the right place. Oh, I hate you, Microsoft. The passion. Here we go.
The drug was administered in a drink of water given at the start of each day's exercise. 25 minutes later, the first effects of the drug became apparent. The men began to relax and to giggle. But this man was more seriously affected and had to be removed from the exercise. After 35 minutes, one of the radio operators had become incapable of using his set, and the efficiency of the rocket launcher team was also very impaired. 10 minutes later, the attacking section had lost all sense of urgency. Notice the bunching and indecision as they enter a wood occupied by the enemy. Almost immediately, the section commander tried to use a map to find the location of troop headquarters, and a prisoner's escort had to have the way pointed out to him, although it was in plain sight, 700 yards away over open country. 50 minutes after taking the drug, radio communication had become difficult, if not impossible, but the men are still capable of sustained physical effort. However, constructive action was still attempted by those retaining a sense of responsibility, in spite of physical symptoms. But 1 hour and 10 minutes after taking the drug, with one man climbing a tree to feed the birds, the troop commander gave up, admitting that he could no longer control himself or his men. He himself then relapsed into laughter.
So, thank you. So, what's going on there? What's going on there is what? What is that? What is that about? They're all smashed. Yeah. They were given LSD. That was the drug that was administered. This is near early, it's 61 to 62, I believe, British experiment. This is not phony, this is real. This video was actually leaked from the UK a few years ago. Nobody knows how it got on YouTube. But I also saw a couple of years ago another video from that they made of this study, and that one fellow who was taken off, had to be taken away, is the centerpiece of the other video. And although this is amusing, the other video makes it much less amusing. He's walking around in a circle, surrounded by what you call it, colleagues and presumably physicians, basically saying, "You know, please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me." So this is a serious business. Somebody's going to leak that one too, and I can show both of them. But there was a lot of interest in the question: could you somehow get one of these hallucinogens into the water supply? This is obviously, you know, taking the idea of throwing horse carcasses into wells that the Confederates did, taking it much further. Could you somehow get this in the water supply? Could you aerosolize it? Aerosolization has never worked too well with any of these things because of sunlight and wind and so forth. But, you know, maybe you could do it somehow. So this is, again, just evidence that of how much interest there was. And this is a joint venture, apparently. The U.S., the U.K., and Canada were working together on these questions in the 50s, sometime through the 60s. So I talked to you about Henry Beecher, the hero of human research ethics. We're not reading his papers, but again, he was one of the people who was certainly involved with helping to at least consult on some of these hallucinogen experiments in the Defense Department and with the CIA in the 50s and 60s. Then we have all my friends, the icons of the generation. LSD becomes the breakaway drug. I've talked about psychedelics already when psychedemia was going on here. And only now, as I think I also mentioned, we're starting to cycle back. 40, 50 years later, cycling back to the original reasons that people were interested in LSD in the medical world, which was as an adjunct to psychotherapy. When I talked to my psychiatrist colleagues, I had a friend over to dinner last night, a psychiatrist in Washington, and I told him about this, and he said, "Bad idea, really bad idea. You do not want to give anybody hallucinogen, particularly anybody who has any reason to go see a psychiatrist in the first place." But there are people. Again, I think I mentioned to you MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, that has FDA permission to use MDMA think it is, and psilocybin, magic mushrooms, in clinical studies with people who are anxious or depressed, particularly people with terminal illness, and they believe they are getting good results, and they believe that the drugs are manageable. Now, the problem is, of course, as one psychiatrist pointed out to me, you give somebody some of this in your office, you can't let them walk out of the street an hour later. Right? The 15-minute hour of psychotherapy doesn't work too well if somebody's walking out and they're tripping still for another 6 or 8 hours. So this remains a problem. You really have to use this stuff, if you're going to use it, in a very controlled environment. The point here is that it's the national security world that takes the original interest in hallucinogens and psychedelics. Now, some of you probably believe in ESP, have experienced this with a certain, perhaps special someone. A famous radio interviewer interviewed me about Mind Wars, I won't tell you who, told me between breaks, that between segments of the radio interview, that she knew exactly what I was talking about in Mind Wars, because she and her husband had this ESP. They always knew, what was going on. Okay, that's fine. I'll go back to Earth now. But there were certainly lots of people who believed this, including anybody here go to Duke? No? So J.B. Ryan, who was the great psychologist at Duke University, was doing ESP studies, parapsychology studies, for many years. And it was only after he died, and he coined the term psychological operations, apparently, psyops, sometimes spelled psyops, but take your choice. He was also, after he died, it turned out, supported or a consultant to the CIA, which was very interested in these questions and whether you could use this stuff. This went on at least until the late 80s. This is a passage from a report the National Research Council did, which you can read. It's on, if you go to the National Academies Press website and type in enhancing human performance, you can read this report. And I'll just read this paragraph to you. I know you can read English, but I have so much fun. And I, reading this paragraph, and I figure as a tenured professor, I get to have some fun once in a while. So this is a quote from Enhancing Human Performance, 1988, National Research Council. The claimed phenomena on applications presented by several military officers range from the incredible to the outrageously incredible. The anti-missile time warp, for example, is somehow supposed to deflect attack from nuclear warheads, so that they will transcend time and explode among the ancient dinosaurs. Now, time out. Okay, I read these stories when I was a kid. My understanding is that if you destroyed the dinosaurs, that we wouldn't show up, and there would be this weird thing that would happen. This is why time travel really doesn't work so well. But I guess they didn't read those stories. So they were working on this, but that would have really bad consequences. So anyway, one suggested application is a conception of the First Earth Battalion made up of warrior monks, including the use of ESP, leaving their bodies at will, levitating, psychic healing, and walking through walls. And this was called, in that text, the mind race. Okay. So this is pre-neuroscience, you might say, but a lot of interest in this. Now, if this will work. Some of you may have seen a film, or at least have seen the trailer of this film.
In the 1880s, British and American Societies for Psychical Research began the first scientific study of paranormal phenomena, investigating claims of ghosts, hauntings, and life after death. The scientist most responsible for shifting the focus to the psychic abilities of the living was Dr. J.B. Ryan, who founded the Institute for Parapsychology at Duke University in 1930. Dr. Ryan brought parapsychology into the laboratory and popularized the phrase ESP to describe what he found.
Well, it does really exist. The implications begin with the basic fact that ESP is non-physical. It shows that there's something that man can do that extends beyond space-time.
Dr. Ryan also investigated and believed in the existence of psychokinesis, the effect of mind over matter. Ryan's work caught on rapidly with the public. It was the Depression era, and people seemed anxious for something to believe in. In fact, his ESP theories were so popular, countless fakes arose to cash in on.
Even though my eyes are sealed, I shall read a newspaper. This is a feature picture page. And
But Wine's work was considered fakery too by mainstream scientists unwilling to accept his controversial theories. And without concrete proof, the public's interest in ESP soon faded.
And it's fine to be high.
It lay dormant for 30 years until the 60s counterculture sparked a resurgence of interest. It was a time, once again, when people were actively seeking new answers. The big name in the field was still J.B. Rhine. Only by now, ESP was taking on a new name, Psi, the Greek letter denoting the unknown. But when the 60s era ended, so did its fads. And
like
widespread
that.
Interest in parapsychology waned once again. 30 years later, we're looking back at 100 years of our own research and that of experimenters worldwide, and looking forward to a new millennium where researchers tell us ESP or psi phenomena could simply...
Okay, so you get the general idea. This goes on and on. This is a weird incident. What was it, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that supposedly John McCain, according to Rolling Stone, was brainwashed. When he went to Iraq, he was brainwashed into thinking that the war in Iraq was going well, and in Afghanistan. And of course, if there's one person you did not want to get involved in allegations of brainwashing, it's Senator McCain, who was a prisoner in North Vietnam and Hanoi for so long. This stuff keeps coming back. Rolling Stone actually had to pull back on this story. They had one informant who turned out to be unreliable. The point is that we're always looking for a new angle. But it often turns out to be the old angle. So in the 1960s, another little piece of social history, history of science, same time that the counterculture was getting more and more interested in parapsychological phenomena, going back to J.B. Rhine, so was the national security establishment. And by the way, so were physicists. If you read a book called From Counterculture to Cyberculture by Fred Turner, who's a historian of science, the same young physicists in the 60s and 70s who were rediscovering concepts like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, Einstein's quantum mechanics, they were getting very interested in the idea of action at a distance. Because after all, according to quantum theory, you can have action at a distance. You don't have to have causation, right? So without going into Schrodinger's cat, some of you remember that perhaps from your high school physics, there was interest in a lot of ways that it reinvigorated parapsychology, interest in parapsychology. Rhine became a star again in the 60s and 70s, and as I just showed you, the national security system also was very interested in these questions. So the psychologist Henry Murray was a big figure here. Did I tell you about the Unabomber and Henry Murray? So this is an interesting story, again, a different angle, not involving drugs. Turns out that Ted Kaczynski was a humiliation experiment that was run by a very important psychologist, personality theorist at Harvard named Henry Murray, who developed the thematic apperception test. My point is that you can do all kinds of mental control, mind control experiments with drugs or without drugs. You can think there's ESP involved, or you can perhaps be implicated in turning somebody into a psychotic. Lots of people were involved in this work in the 50s and 60s. This is Kurt Lewin, who's the founder. If anybody takes a social psychology course, chapter one is Kurt Lewin, father of modern social psychology, also a consultant to the Office for Strategic Services. Martha, before we get started, I'm going to just do a little bit of the psychopharmacology, and then we can come back to your stuff. So I think I did a little bit of this last time, just want to make sure I did. We were talking a few weeks ago, and I was talking about the psychedelic stuff. This is now stuff that we've already talked about in this class. I think we talked about modafinil already. I encourage you to get some for all of your classes in bioethics. Did we talk about oxytocin? You'll do that?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to get to oxytocin, also known as the love hormone. And just, you know, to make you see that it's not just about love. This is actually what oxytocin looks like on its protein. It carries it around upper on the upper right-hand corner. That's what love looks like, but Martha will tell you more about love a little bit more. And then we have the idea that maybe you could even use something like beta blockers to prevent post-traumatic stress disorder. This is not anything I think that's been shown to be the case. There's a weak signal that maybe beta blockers and talk therapy can be used, can be beneficial to people who have had severe trauma. maybe we'll come back to this as well. Could it also prevent people from having guilt feelings in the first place? It's an idea that people have kicked around. I don't think that anybody thinks that oxytocin, rather that beta blockers can actually do this, but it's a matter of speculation. Didn't tell you about commatives, did I? So commatives are a class of aerosols that can basically calm people down. This is the top half of a two-page contract that was led by the Marine Corps Research University, which is at Penn State. By the way, many people at Penn State don't know that the Marine Corps Research University is there. I think it actually exists mostly on paper. But this is an interesting project. This is the, you can see the title. This is dated, by the way, a week after 9/11. And this is, the title of this is A Technical Assessment of the 81mm Non-Lethal Mortar Munition. So, I saw non-lethal mortar. Okay. So, I grew up with, you know, Sergeant Fury comic books, World War II movies with John Wayne. And as far as I knew, they were all using mortars to kill people. So what would a non-lethal mortar be? I called my friend at Fort Detrick to ask him. He thought for a second, and he said, I think it would be something that would put you to sleep. So this is what it looks like. An aerosolized non-lethal mortar, a simulant, because you can't use the real stuff, because that would be a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention if you did. And this has been used in at least one famous case that you may remember from 2002, when the Chechens took over this theater doing a musical production called Nordest. They had 700 people in the theater. They let some of the kids go, some of the very sick people go. This was a several-day siege in the theater. Finally, the Russian Special Forces decided to solve the problem by apparently pumping a version of what is known as fentanyl, an opiate, into the HVAC system. After a few minutes, they put people to sleep. They then proceeded to go into the theater. They had a firefight with some of the men, and then they found some of the women who were asleep with bombs strapped around their bodies, and they shot them. That was the end of that problem. So this was probably not the best day in the history of the National Academy of Sciences. 128, maybe 130 people died. Most of the children died because they were bringing these people out unconscious, and the emergency medical technicians didn't know why they were unconscious. There is an antidote to fentanyl, but they didn't know why they were unconscious, so they died. Same day that that happened, the National Academy of Sciences published a report recommending centers of excellence in what are called non-lethal weapons, including riot control, crowd control devices like opiates, like commatives, like fentanyl. Probably not a good idea. So I'm actually going to stop there. I think this is a good place to stop, take a break. We're going to talk for the next few minutes about deception detection, about some of the other stuff that is relevant to the technical side of mind wars. Unless you have questions, we'll... Actual questions. Oh, by the way, I should say, in the case of the theater tragedy, the Dubrovka Theater in Moscow, interestingly, this went 60 some odd of these of the families of the people who died went to the, one of the international courts, and they got a ruling a few months ago that the use of this commative, this opiate, was negligent. And they actually awarded, I think it was 130 million euros or something, to the families. Now, whether the family that has to be given by the Russian government, now whether the Russian state will ever actually give anybody any money, I don't know. But it is sort of interesting that that there was a ruling on this case. Now, you might be thinking of the Chemical Weapons Convention just before we break, wonder why it wouldn't have applied. Was this a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention? And the answer is probably not, because this was used basically in a police action. This was the terrorists were not fighting under a flag, as they say. They did not represent, they were not fighters of a sovereign state. Therefore, this was not a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, because these conventions govern relationships between sovereign states, not within sovereign states. which actually means, by the way, that if a police organization in the U.S. wanted to use one of these aerosols to break up a demonstration, now we know the FBI never tries to break up demonstrations, but if they did, that was facetious, by the way, if they used it here, there's actually, that would not be a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And there might be no domestic law that actually covered that kind of police use of this kind of agent. So the irony is, you know, you're more protected from other countries with respect to some of this stuff than you are protected in your own country. So I'll stop there. Let's take a five-minute break, and we'll move on to some imaging stuff.
1st.
That's hilarious. How long is that? It's not bad at all.
Who's it like on this moment?
Is it comfortable? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. A good time? A couple times.
So let's see.
Sure, go ahead.
Cool. Is my voice audible?
Yeah, it's picking up.
Fantastic. Great. Okay, we're going to start up again. So obviously Jonathan is the expert on, you know, neuroethical issues in national security. There are just a couple of aspects of that topic that I'm going to tell you about, partly review from what you've heard from Jonathan and from what I've talked about in the past. So, we're going to talk about the use of fMRI to detect deception. People usually talk about this in the context of neuro law, but it's also relevant to interrogation, trying to figure out if somebody's telling the truth. You know, you can't really force somebody to tell the truth. People try torture, and that doesn't work. So wouldn't it be nice if at least we could discriminate between when they're telling the truth and when they're lying. The idea is maybe brain imaging could help us with that. And then the use of oxytocin, as Jonathan said, the love hormone, to try to encourage interrogees to speak truthfully to you. So first, fMRI lie detection. Lie detection in general, whether it's fMRI or the traditional polygraph, is based on the idea that the mental state of lying, the mental process of lying, has certain physiological correlates. They don't have to be sort of invariably correlated, but they have to be correlated well enough that this physiological measure is a useful indicator that somebody's lying or telling the truth. And traditionally, people have used activity of the autonomic nervous system to do that, specifically the sympathetic nervous system. So here's a little table that I took from an intro physiological psychology book talking about the sort of different kind of countervailing effects of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic branches of the autonomic nervous system. When your sympathetic system is predominating, that's when you are feeling aroused, excited, jangled. If there was a big noise suddenly in the hallway right now, all of your sympathetic nervous systems would become engaged. And you would. Your pupils would dilate. Your mouth would get drier. You'd tend to perspire. You'd breathe more quickly. You know, your heart would start to beat more quickly, etc. Now, it turns out that when you're telling a lie, especially when you know the people who are questioning you want to know the truth and perhaps don't believe you, you are in a state of sympathetic arousal. You are feeling kind of jangled. Okay. For that reason, going back as far as ancient China, they used a method where they, basically used the fact that sympathetic activity goes up when people lie. They had people take a mouthful of dry rice, and then they interrogated them. And because the sympathetic nervous system decreases salivation, it makes your mouth dry, they could tell, or they thought they could tell, whether somebody was telling the truth or not by how much trouble they had, articulating and speaking with a mouthful of dry rice. If the saliva sort of wasn't flowing normally and, moistening the contents of their mouth and making it easier for them to speak, they said, okay, this person is lying. More recently, the polygraph, which you all know, right? It's called polygraph because it measures many channels at once. Respiration, heart rate, perspiration, galvanic skin response, and and blood pressure, right? Now, interestingly, the technology for the polygraph started with the work of a guy in the sort of teens and 20s at Harvard. He was a psychology graduate student, and he noticed that when people were speaking about emotional content, and when they were lying, their blood pressure went up. He was measuring blood pressure in the cuff. And this guy, William Marston, was quite a character, actually. One could have a very entertaining lecture just on him. among his various projects was the inventing the cartoon character Wonder Woman. So Marston was not only doing research on blood pressure and truth-telling, he also invented Wonder Woman. He was kind of a feminist, but he was kind of a sexist feminist. He was really kind of a character. But who knows what that is? That's the lasso. You know what kind of special lasso it is? It's the lasso of truth, also called the magic lasso. And the idea is that if Wonder Woman lassos you in her magic lasso, you cannot lie. And Marston was said to have gotten the idea for this by the sort of, blood pressure cuff that he used to tell whether people were telling the truth. So, she would cinch it around you and force you to tell the truth. Okay, so we know that the polygraph has been widely used, still is used, and alas, all I really have time to say here and now is it's not known to be very reliable. Okay.
How many women in the room would like to have that on a date? So can I raise a philosophical question?
Sure.
Which we've talked about. What is a lie?
What is a lie? Okay, moving right along. No, I mean, the thing is, that is a tough question. I mean, there are all kinds of layers of, are you fooling yourself as well as other people? Should we lump little white lies into, you don't look like you've gained 10 pounds. I can't believe it. Should we lump those into the same category, either, morally or even psychologically, neurologically, as the lie, no, I didn't shoot a man in Reno just to watch him die. Clearly there's a lot of conceptual work to be done here, as Jonathan points out. And some of it is relevant to the way in which we evaluate technologies for lie detection, because you don't want to, for example, do the validation experiments on no, you don't look like you gained a pound, and then try to find out if somebody shot a man in Reno using this technology, right? Yeah. They may not necessarily be the same thing from the point of view of what's going on in the brain. But aside from saying that, I am going to totally, totally dodge that important but difficult question and just go on to say, okay, in addition to looking at the autonomic nervous system, we can also look at the brain. And fMRI lie detection as a way of trying to detect whether somebody is lying or not. Now, whereas the polygraph, the mouthful of rice method, all previous methods of physiological correlates as lie detectors depend on basically the emotion evoked by the act of lying, the sort of nervousness, fear, etc. Brain-based lie detection, and in particular fMRI, uses not the emotion, but the cognition of a lie. How do the cognitive processes of telling a lie differ from the cognitive processes of telling the truth? And, basically, on average, in college sophomores that get dragged into scanners for these experiments, the cognitive processes do differ. In particular, lying is more effortful, more complex. You have to be able to simultaneously hold in mind your true understanding of reality and your story. Okay, and those are two things that are sort of mutually inconsistent. And that is complicated, effortful. And who here has studied enough neuroscience to know what part of the brain tends to show up when you're doing something complicated and effortful? take a guess. Frontalobes, exactly. And that's what we tend to see when we're contrasting truth-telling and lying in the skin. So, a little memory refresh here. Do you remember this slide? Okay, this is interrogating you. Do you remember this slide? Okay, from a few weeks ago. Okay, we talked about forward inference, which is typically what happens in a cognitive experiment, and then quote-unquote reverse inference, where you're using an observed pattern of brain activation to figure out what psychological process must have caused it. Okay. Well, brain-based lie detection is basically reverse inference. Okay. Early work by people like Daniel Langlevin, who is a professor here at Penn in psychiatry, was forward inference. It was saying, I am interested in deception and the brain. I wonder what the brain looks like when it's lying compared to when it's telling the truth. So he put sophomores in scanners, had them lie or tell the truth, and found certain differences, which in retrospect were not too surprising in terms of the prefrontal activity that accompanies lying. But then he recognized an interesting possible application for this basic science, and that is maybe I could make a brain-based lie detector. And so, in fact, he licensed the idea, or Penn licensed the idea, to a company with the very amusing name No Lie MRI. And they did the reverse inference. So they said, we're going to put people in the scanner, we're going to have them tell what they claim is the truth, and we're going to look at the brain activity and see if it looks more like a lie or more like truth. And there's also been some work on pattern classifiers too, but we won't go into that now. So here is the website of No Lie MRI. Let's see, what kind of flamboyant claims do they make? The first and only direct measure of truth verification and lie detection in human history, as opposed to, I don't know, dog history. let me mention, actually, while I make a little bit of fun of this, Daniel Langlevin, the inventor of the method, has severed all relations with this company. He thinks they have galloped way ahead too fast and are making claims that really can't be supported. You can imagine that there are situations in which people might turn to this method where, something really bad could happen if the method gives the wrong answer, right? Somebody who's lying could be thought to be truthful, or somebody who's truthful could be thought to be lying. So Daniel has really turned his back on this. But the company continues, and you can see from this little box on their website some of the differences in brain activity that result from the comparison of lying versus telling the truth. So in the quote-unquote forward inference, what you find is when you tell people to lie about something, you get this medial prefrontal activation. When they're not lying, when they're telling the truth, it's other more posterior areas that light up. Of course, different studies operationalizing lying and truth-telling in different ways get slightly different, or not so slightly different, patterns of activation. It's another cause for concern that maybe this isn't a really robust, generalizable method. But in general, rule of thumb, all these methods show more prefrontal activation with lying. Yeah.
So does that activation mean that you're trying to think up new things, or does it mean that you're trying to suppress things that you really know are the truth?
Well, that's a good question. I think the assumption has been more the latter. Uh-huh. more like, you know, okay, no, I actually wasn't in Reno. I was, you know, in the other place. But, like, you know, questions of, like, you know, in detail, what are the cognitive processes that give rise to this are not well known. Yeah.
So are you saying that, like, say when they're going through this test, someone tells them to not tell the truth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Which, okay, so now we're getting into the question of, like, you know, sort of how realistic are the circumstances under which this thing is tested and validated, right? You know, if the friendly experimenter is telling you to lie, that's a little different from the unfriendly, you know, interrogator at Guantanamo demanding the truth. Okay, so does it work? Well, it does. It depends on what you mean by work. I mean, if you are a cognitive neuroscientist who's, you know, interested for whatever reason in generalizing about, you know, sort of lying in the brain, and is lying, does that really activate different patterns from truth-telling? Well, yeah. I mean, on average, it works. But it doesn't always work. I mean, nothing always works, right? Nothing always works. So then the question is, well, how much error can we tolerate? And for some things, we can tolerate lots of error. You know, if you're getting a, you know, oh, I don't know, I won't make up silly examples, but, you know, you can imagine, right? But for national security applications, the consequences of either false positive or false negative could be very serious. A colleague of Jonathan's and mine, Jonathan Marks at Penn State also, he's a lawyer and a bioethicist, and, you know, he's written about the dangers of prematurely adopting brain imaging technology for use in interrogation. And he points out that, you know, the motivation may initially be a really positive one. It's like, let's avoid, you know, roughing people up. Let's avoid torturing people. Let's just, you know, use a nice, like, painless, simple brain scan that will tell us whether they're telling the truth or not. But if the scan seems to suggest, whether it does so accurately or not, that somebody's lying, might that not justify even greater brutality against the person, right? Like, the scan says he's lying, so let's just, you know, keep waterboarding him until he fesses up. I mean, it's kind of ironic. It's like with the non-lethal weapons, right? The non-lethal weapon in the Chechenian, you know, tragedy, knocked people out, the police came in, and then they shot the people. It's like, what's the point of having a non-lethal weapon, right? Well, you know, similarly, this kind of method could, you know, when you're thinking of all the different scenarios that could play out, if it's not accurate, it could, in fact, Jonathan Marks has pointed out, kind of license, you know, worse treatment of people. So what are, you know, that's a false positive, where somebody isn't lying, but the scan seems to say that it is. They are. You know, false negative. I mean, we've had terrible cases of false negatives with the polygraph, leading to terrible compromises in national security. There was a case maybe 3 years ago. I think it was 2009. In Afghanistan, where this doctor who was, they thought he was a double agent, but he was actually, I don't know if you can say he's actually a triple agent or a single agent. He was, you know, he really wasn't on our side. And he met with a group of CIA agents and blew everybody up, and like 7 different people died. This man had been vetted by the polygraphers. He had passed his polygraph. So clearly, false positives and false negatives in these kinds of situations are really serious. And so, you know, you really want to, it's not good enough to be able to say, wow, you know, 90% of the time we can tell if it's a lie or not, because 10% may be too high a risk for certain applications.
Would it work differently on someone who, I'll say, mentally ill? And I don't mean severely, but obviously some of these people do these sorts of things. There's,
yes,
you know,
that
so
is a fantastic question. I suspect there is a literature on that for the polygraph, but I actually am sorry to say I couldn't tell you what the finding is. You know, psychopaths are supposed to be, are supposed to not, their nerves don't get jangled easily. You know, you might expect psychopaths to be cooler in terms of polygraphy. Do you know anything about
well,
that?
Well, I don't know about the polygraphy, but this is a huge problem for interrogators in the context of terrorism. If you talk to the people who do interrogation, they'll tell you that many of the people that they have to interrogate in places like Iraq and Afghanistan who have been picked up are mentally ill. And that's one of the reasons that they are used by terrorist organizations, because they're mentally ill.
Interesting.
In many cases, they are also on some kind of drug. You think about the kamikaze pilots in World War II, they were all drunk. There was a reason they were drinking the bonsai right before they took off in the movies, because they were plastered. Otherwise, a normal person doesn't fly their plane into a vessel. Right? So that is a problem, because mental illness does make it very difficult to interrogate somebody and use rational strategies. There are a couple of things that I was told by the guy who actually runs the what's called the high-value detainee interrogation booth, and this is not classified, obviously. One is, I asked him in a meeting, who's the hardest person, what's the best defense I can use to being interrogated? And he said, be stupid. Stupid people are the hardest people to interrogate. Again, because we're using rational processes, you know, we're trying to connect the dots, and we're asking certain leading questions, and if they don't get it, a lot of people are stupid. The other thing he said that was very interesting is, and other interrogators said, is that, and this is not sort of mental illness, but delusions of grandeur. Many people who are picked up feel that they're very important to the organization. And they've been told how important they are to the organization, which is why we're giving you this important assignment. So they prevaricate. They give you information that's a lot of bullshit, because they think that way they can make themselves look more important. And that actually, one interrogator told me, creates huge problems, huge waste of time. It takes them quite a while in many sessions to realize this person actually has no identity, but has these kind of, you know, wants to be important. And actually, one of the approaches that is used in interrogation is, in fact, to tell people, we know you're very important, and we know you know a lot of things. It's called ego up. It's a psychological strategy. You know, we know you're very important. We know you know things. That's why we're talking to you. We're spending a lot of time with you. So you can really appeal to somebody who is deluded into thinking they're important by appealing to their sense of self-importance. Sorry, that was good. But it's quite
interesting
how difficult the psychology is. Quite apart from the deception detection, which adds so many new layers of complexity.
Yeah. But I think, you know, sort of this question about, like, so we've now gone from this point to this point, like, you know, who is the potential liar? Psychopathology is a biggie, you know, and personality and intelligence. Maybe that pretty much sums it up. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else. That's probably it. Well, also, you know, somebody who's practiced, who has been trained in countermeasures, you know, that kind of thing. In the lab or in the real world, I mean, this is huge, right? If you are being, you know, paid $25, you know, to come in and pretend you've stolen a ring, you know, or lie about the playing card that you're holding, right? I mean, think of all the ways in which that is a really different mental state to be in from if you really are, like if you're on trial, in a criminal trial, or if you're, you know, God forbid, you know, in Guantanamo or someplace like that, and people are interrogating you about very, very serious things. And part of the real world, I mean, there are many different ways in which the real world differs from the lab. This is a great thing to remind oneself periodically. The stakes, which is what we've just been talking about, the stakes are much higher. The emotional involvement is much higher. In addition, real world lies tend to not be just, you know, made up on the spur of the moment. It tends to be, you know, if you're being asked about, you know, your involvement with Al-Qaeda or, you know, your involvement with a crime, chances are you've, by the time you come to the lie detection situation, you've had lots and lots of time to think about that, to compose your story, to sort of live with it. It's very familiar. It may be, you know, more familiar. It may seem more natural to you than the truth, right? So that's another way in which lab and real world differ. In the lab, people basically, you know, have all of, 45 minutes experience with the lie, and in the last 15, they get scanned or something, right? So the question is, how would we find out? I mean, here we've enumerated some of the ways in which we know lie detection is going to be hard to do, and we won't be surprised if it doesn't work. It doesn't mean it can't work, right? How can we find out if it works or not? Well, it turns out you can imagine studies that would answer this question well enough, right? I mean, again, nothing's 100%. You know, clinical trials, I mean, we never know for sure for everybody that a certain drug is going to work. But how could you find out? Well, a biostatistician named Peter Imrie, who was part of the study committee for the National Academy of Sciences that reviewed the polygraph about 8 or 10 years ago now, has gotten interested in fMRI lie detection. And he has kind of sketched out a design for a study that could actually give us the answer. And he estimates that the cost would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars to do it. But if our society really wants to know, they could probably afford to do this. It probably makes sense to wait and make that kind of investment after the scientists have tinkered a little more and gotten a slightly more promising method. But basically, what he proposes to do is this, and this is in the context of the criminal justice system rather than national security. He says, go around and you find people who've been arrested for crimes, and the first thing you do is scan them and ask them, you know, what happened, get their scan, and then you let the normal investigative process go forward. In some cases, you know, I mean, the court always has to decide, like, is somebody guilty or not guilty, but in some cases, the evidence will be kind of like, this is kind of our best decision on the basis of the evidence we have. In other cases, you know, you find evidence that is really definitively proof of guilt or really definitively proof of innocence. You take those cases, and then you look back at the brain scans, okay, that you've collected, and you validate your brain scan criteria for truth or lie based on the eventual outcome of cases, which, as I say, you know, in the end had really compelling evidence. But, I mean, you think about what that would be like to do in the real world, and it's not surprising that Peter Imray says, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. Anyway.
So let me see what's next on our...
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, just because this is neuroethics, not just neuro, you know, it's worth, you know, it's worth reflecting on what the consequences of overconfidence, you know, in this technology would be for human beings and for society. I mean, it's the danger isn't just letting a bad guy go, right? The danger isn't just wrongly, you know, convicting an innocent person. It's also letting bad guys go. And of course, as we've, you know, observed many times, Jonathan and I here, you know, neuroscience has this high-tech allure. It's very persuasive. And so the danger is that people might use these methods and not understand just how fallible they are. And, you know, they might be. I mean, it's not hard to imagine people being overconfident in brain-based lie detection. And clearly, you know, bad things could result from that. So now, in the last few minutes, I'm going to segue to my favorite hormone, oxytocin. Oxytocin is really a nice hormone. It's a neuropeptide, which means it is, it's just a protein that can act like a hormone or a neurotransmitter, either or. And it plays a role in parenting behavior, and it's believed evolutionarily to have started there in parenting, in mother-child bonding. Actually, mother-child parturition. It's involved in labor. So, you know, you've probably heard that when a woman has labor induced, they give her a shot of Pitocin. Is it a shot or a... Yeah, I guess it's a shot. Intravenous, whatever. Pitocin is a synthetic oxytocin. And what that does is make the uterus start to contract and push the baby out. Nature has come up with the clever idea of using that same hormone, since, you know, a mother having just given birth to a baby is awash in oxytocin to make the baby come out, to give that hormone a role in psychological bonding, emotional bonding. So that helps the mother start to get off on the right foot with the baby and love the baby. Oxytocin is also secreted when you nurse a baby. So again, it sort of encourages, you know, the mother to bond with the child. Sort of opportunism of evolution, then, or maybe the, what would you call it, the sort of the tendency of evolution to sort of recycle things and, you know, use something that's already there for something else, it then acquired a role in pair bonding for species that do have pair bonding, so that after sex, each person secretes oxytocin, and that makes the people feel more emotionally bonded to each other. So
better than a cigarette.
right, oxytocin and nicotine. Now, it turns out that in the last, I don't know, this is pretty recent, maybe 10 years, people have been investigating a role for oxytocin beyond procreation and parenting. It turns out that oxytocin modulates, modifies one's feelings for all kind of people, not just your lover and your baby. There we go. We know this in part from studies of giving people oxytocin, okay, as opposed to just measuring endogenously produced oxytocin, although those studies also exist and are very consistent with this. But there's nothing like an experimental intervention to really like nail down the causality, right? And it turns out if you actually come along and give Jonathan some oxytocin right now, he will, when he's grading your exam, he'll be, you know, much more kind of nice and forgiving and say, oh, I know they were really trying, so I'll just, you know, treat them all up to an A. Okay, so what do we know about the effects of exogenously administered oxytocin? Well, parenting. It actually influences parenting. There was a study done a year or so ago now where they gave fathers either oxytocin or placebo and had them play with their toddlers or preschool children, videotape the play sessions, and had blind raters rate how good the fathers were as parents, how attentive, warm, affectionate, etc. they were. And guess what? The guys that got the oxytocin were rated as better fathers than the guys that got the placebo. Economic games. So you've probably heard of games like the Prisoner's Dilemma, the Ultimatum game, these kinds of games. They're very simple, structured situations in which, you know, you are giving or exchanging money or, you know, play money points, whatever. Behavioral economists use them to try to study how people make decisions. They often involve pitting selfish motives against more altruistic motives, competitive strategies against cooperative strategies, and so forth. Well, it turns out if you get people to play these games on oxytocin and placebo, you find that when they have the oxytocin, they are more generous, more inclined to transfer more money, real money or play money, to the other player. They are more forgiving if someone is stingy with them and untrustworthy. Not, you know, not infinitely, but they're much more likely to give a second chance to somebody. More trusting, more likely to go for a cooperative strategy that, you know, where they'll lose if the other person doesn't cooperate too, and so forth. So this is quite interesting from a basic science point of view, quite chilling from a point of view of, you know, could an unscrupulous business person make use of this? Now, one thing I need to tell you is that, you know, this process of administering oxytocin is not so easy. So you can't really slip it into somebody's drink when they go to the bathroom. It does not cross the blood-brain barrier, or at least not very easily. If you administer it intranasally, for reasons that I don't understand, enough passes through the nasal epithelium that you actually do get some into the brain. But this means that you are doing something that somebody would surely notice at a business meeting. That said, there are drug companies working on molecules that will activate the oxytocin system. And that do cross the blood-brain barrier. Because oxytocin has some interesting therapeutic potential for psychiatric disorders that involve, you know, abnormalities in social relations, mainly autism, also schizophrenia. Anyway, so if we get some of those drugs, then that's not a totally crazy scenario. You know, the idea that, you know, before a tough negotiation, that you might worry somebody has, you know, sort of primed your oxytocin system surreptitiously. Information sharing. So I added this as a separate bullet point because it's especially relevant to interrogation. I think there's just one study on this at this point, but subjects with oxytocin on board are much more likely to spontaneously offer personal information to strangers than the subjects given placebo. So clearly that has interrogation potential. And in general, you know, Jonathan mentioned, you know, ego up. I don't know what the similar lingo is for just developing rapport, but developing rapport is a really important part of interrogation, yeah. Right? And, you know, this is a molecule that just predisposes you to feel rapport with people. So clearly that could be used in that way. Kinder, gentler interrogation? Well, yes, quite possibly. However, there is a dark side to oxytocin. That's not my description, so people have talked about that. It's a little unpredictable when you get this and when you don't, but there are circumstances where if you're dealing with people who you are implicitly classifying as not your group, you will actually treat them more harshly and less generously with oxytocin added than with placebo, which kind of makes sense. Again, if it's all about bonding, you know, you might expect evolution to make you sort of, you know, to give you a molecule that makes you love your brother, love your neighbor, but, that guy from the other city or the other political party or the other, you know, country, whatever, maybe not so much. And, in fact, it looks like it's not just that it isn't effective for out-group members, it's actually effective in decreasing your niceness. So a little hard to predict, but you could easily imagine that backfiring big time if you're interrogating somebody who thinks, you know, you're from the great Satan. And let's see. Oh, okay. And again, with 2 minutes to go, let me just say ethics. Well, with 2 minutes, let me just say this. I think this is a really great case that. So with neuroethics, we typically sort of talk about the societal impact and so forth. We never really think a lot about different normative ethical theories and how they intersect with these neurotechnologies. But I think this is a very interesting case in that, to me, I feel attracted to the idea of using these, you know, using oxytocin in this way. From a consequentialist point of view, because it seems like, well, great, if you cannot have to torture people and really get them to just kind of feel like they want to tell you what's really going on, well, that's wonderful. But from a deontological Kantian point of view, this just seems like horribly perverted. It's like you are... Because what you're doing is you're not just manipulating somebody's mind. You're manipulating the very part of their mind that makes them care for others, that makes them kind human beings. And you're doing that for your own selfish motives. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just icky squared, right? So, and also, I think one could probably... I mean, I'm actually writing a paper on oxytocin, and this is the part that I'm just starting to write, so I clearly need to think it through a bit. But, you know, there is this idea of the ethics of care. I think it's a feminist ethics or whatever. And again, from that point of view, isn't that kind of disgusting to... Yeah. So anyway. So with that, I will just basically say, you know, I'll leave it to you to sort of think through the ethics in different frameworks and how this might actually play out. I don't think this is science fiction. I think this is, you know, definitely coming our way. May well already be used.
And the person who has really published the most about this is an economist, who we both know, Paul Zak, at Claremont Graduate School, not a psychologist or a neuroscientist. And I think Zak is certainly well known in the national security community, and there's a lot of interest in oxytocin.
Yeah.
A lot of interest. Still very speculative, and, you know, it's early days, but a lot of interest. The device that he, I think he contracted with people to design is basically to get the stuff in your nose is an injector kind of thing.
It's like a syringe.
And you do have to get quite a bit of it, apparently. So it ain't, as Martha said, it would be pretty obvious on a date. and it's not pleasant to go through it. So, but it does apparently get past the blood-brain barrier enough of it, but you have to give quite a bit of it to make it.
Don't date asthmatics.
Yeah. I actually asked Zach once, I told him once, and then I'll let you go, that I was in a class talking about oxytocin, and then some undergraduates a couple of weeks ago said that they showed me dating sites. Do you know this? Date rape sites that talked about oxytocin. And I told Paul that, and he like stepped back 8 feet. He said, no. He said, it makes you more trusting, but not more gullible. Which you can say, is that a fine line, or is that a philosophically defensible distinction in behavior? I don't know. But I didn't know until just now that there are companies that are working on something that could be what, dissolved in water.
Yeah.
That would be a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. Okay, so next time, thank you. We have a lot of ground to cover for the next class. We'll move on to some more technical device-oriented stuff in the brain. And we're going to also talk about minimally conscious states, because I didn't get to it tonight. A couple of people sent me something that I want to talk about next week.